From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, is back in the news 3 years after it sparked a national debate about policing and race. That's because over the weekend, new video of the African-American teenager came to light. The video appears to show him hours before his death, appearing to hand a bag to clerks in the same convenience store that police claimed he later robbed. Now, the person who released the security camera video is a filmmaker who's a protege of Michael Moore, and he says the video shows a marijuana deal. Police chiefs say they've never seen the footage, and they never saw it during their investigation. Joining us is Christine Byers, crime reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And Christine, what exactly does Michael Brown do in this video?
It appears he takes something out of his pocket and then puts it on the counter, and it appears to be a small bag. And it's put on the counter, and then you see the store clerks handling some boxes of cigarillos behind the counter, and it doesn't really show definitively what exactly it is. And then at some point, you also see the store clerks appearing to smell it. The police chiefs that I spoke to, former Chief Tom Jackson in Ferguson and St. Louis County Chief John Belmer, have both said that allegations of any kind of marijuana transaction are new to them.
I understand that the police chiefs say they had never seen this store security camera video before. How is that possible?
Well, that's correct. And I mean, it's not unusual for police chiefs to not really get into the weeds on every investigation and the nuances. And so there was some mention of an earlier encounter with Mike Brown in that store before the fatal encounter. But if they deemed it was not relevant at the time to brief the police chief about, that's not unusual for them to have not seen the footage or be aware of it.
Mm. Now, okay, so this new video may create some controversy or tension or different narratives around what happened or didn't happen in that store before the police shooting of Michael Brown. But, and obviously lots of questions still to answer there. You've been following this story all weekend. What's the mood in Ferguson right now? How are the people reacting to this latest development?
There is a group of protesters that grew to about 100 last night that went to Ferguson Market. And I think the feeling among them is that this footage sort of challenges this notion that this was a robbery, and that Mike Brown was, his mindset was he didn't want to go to jail for having just committed a robbery, and that's why he was angry when he encountered Darren Wilson. I think it's just the notion that there's additional information still coming out at this point in time, 3 years later, and just a feeling of mistrust that exists there.
Is anyone calling for a reopening of the investigation, given what's perhaps shown in this new video?
I haven't heard that yet. We're supposed to be seeing additional footage coming from the Ferguson Market attorney that he says is uncut and shows a more complete picture of what exactly transpired in that encounter at Ferguson Market. So I don't think there would be necessarily reopening. The only reopening, I think, on the police perspective would be if there was an alleged marijuana transaction that took place there, they'd obviously want to investigate whether a crime took place. But that's why I think we're going to have to wait and see what more footage comes out and what it shows. You know, the other interesting thing, too, that was brought up in interviews with the police chiefs, too, is that this is the first time Leslie McSpadden has made the allegation that her son was involved in a marijuana transaction there. And that was not brought up at any point in time with her interviews with the FBI, with the county police, and all the other investigations. It was never discussed.
Mm. And, of course, she's Michael Brown's mother. But one more last question for you. I mean, do we know whether law enforcement, not necessarily the chiefs, but, you know, anyone in Ferguson law enforcement had this video? Because I thought that I was under the impression that they said that they had released everything that they had, and yet all of a sudden we see there's some new video coming from somewhere else.
Right, and that's what we need to further investigate that. I mean, there was certainly mention in the grand jury documents of an earlier encounter with Mike Brown at that store, but there was, again, no connection to some sort of marijuana deal. that went down there. And it wasn't unusual for him or anyone to be in that store frequently, as it was, you know, visited oftentimes by people in the community because it's a very convenient location and people go in and out of there all the time. So had there been an allegation that there was some sort of marijuana deal made by anyone at any point in time, I think it would have become more front and center. But again, this is the first time that this allegation of a marijuana transaction has surfaced.
I see. Christine Byers is a crime reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Christine, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we look at healthcare, one aspect is often overlooked. According to the National Rural Health Association, a third of the country's 1,800 rural hospitals are at risk of going under, including 8 in rural Colorado. Reporter John Daly of Here Now contributor Colorado Public Radio took a trip to the town of Hugo in the Eastern Plains and found the hospital plays a big role.
When you pull into Hugo, 100 miles east of Denver, you're greeted by one grocery store, one restaurant, one liquor store, one historic railroad roundhouse, two bars, and an antique store.
Main Street Mamas.
You're the Main Street Mama?
I am the main mama. I am indeed.
That's Linda Orrell. She sits on a bar stool in what used to be an old pool hall. She says Hugo is pretty small.
It's about 825 or so, maybe 850 on a good year. It's remained about that for a long, long time.
It's held steady, she says, because it's a good place to live.
It's a town that people tend to come back to retire, and it is home.
Just up the hill is Hugo's hospital, Lincoln Community Hospital and Care Center.
Hello, good sir. Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
Nice. Rachel Smith is the nursing director. Smith gives me a tour of the 15-bed critical access facility. From the outside, Lincoln Community Hospital looks more like a small 1960s-era apartment building, but it has all the essential high-tech healthcare equipment, modern imaging machines, telemedicine, even an AirLife helicopter. Smith says the thing that sets it apart is the quality of its care.
You know, it's not treat them and street them. It's definitely somebody you're going to see maybe even later that day, later that week.
Smith grew up here. Her mom, Linda Messer, is the lab director. Messer says what defines Lincoln Community Hospital is the sense of community that comes with being in a small town.
And the thing that I like best about rural health is that I get to take care of all my friends and family, so it's rare that I don't know everybody that we take care of.
Therapy, please call 3213.
The close therapy, connections are easily seen here. In one room at the hospital, there's retiree Ken Sterling.
Here in Hugo.
You're based in Hugo. Okay.
Yeah, this is my hometown.
Yeah,
I grew up here.
Sterling is 86. Yeah. He was in the Navy, then did appliance repair, and even served as mayor. He's recovering from back surgery. Sterling's dad edited the local paper, the Eastern Colorado Plainsman, and helped build the hospital back in the 50s. There's a reason it's in Hugo.
Yeah, I don't know how much you've driven out in this part of the country, but there's a whole lot of nothing. And people have a tendency to get a lead foot. There are a lot of car accidents on 24 especially.
The interstate is about 15 miles away, so a lot of people pass through the area. But officially, there are just 5,500 people in all of Lincoln County, a population density of about 2 people per square mile. Sterling says the hospital is vital.
There are an awful lot of people that depend on this place. And now I'm talking about the people that work here. I'm talking about people that get care here.
People like Ted Lyons down the hall recovering from an infection. Lyons is 69 and was a cattle rancher and a Republican county commissioner for more than a decade in a county where 4 of 5 residents voted for Donald Trump. He's been watching a lot of C-SPAN on TV, including the push to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Lyons says he'd like Trump to visit Hugo's hospital.
I thought I'd call, write a letter to Trump and see if he was flying over in his helicopter. He could land out here on this helipad and come visit what the real hospital is about.
Lyons agrees with President Trump that Obamacare needs to change.
I don't think it's worth having. It leaves too many loopholes, you know.
He co-owns a bar in town where he's heard people's stories, including one couple who saw their insurance premiums skyrocket.
They said their insurance went from $400 a month to $1,200 a month, and then that outfit quit, so they was totally without insurance.
Lyons is covered by Medicare, like half the hospital's patients. One chronic problem is that reimbursement to hospitals for Medicare doesn't cover the full cost of their services. Lyons was on the hospital's board when it nearly shut down a couple of decades ago. He wants lawmakers to work together to keep the parts of Obamacare that work and fix funding for hospitals.
Well, I said you don't drown the duck to get a feather out of him.
Down the hall, Ken Sterling, too, supports whatever helps save his hometown hospital.
Don't even talk about losing this place. That would be a tragedy, really.
But they both know rural hospital finances are tricky. And as Congress aims to reform health care once more, many small-town facilities like Lincoln County Hospital are on thin ice. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
It's Here and Now. Questions about Russian interference in not just the U.S. election, but democratic elections around the world. Their seizing of Crimea, not to mention accusations that Russian President Putin has his opponents poisoned. Well, this is all not doing much to help the image that most Americans have of Russians. Come on, admit it. It's this.
You are not here to ask questions. You forget to whom you're speaking.
Rosa Klebb from the 1963 Bond movie From Russia with Love. Then there's this.
I'm going to bed, and we'll talk more as soon as you...
No, not as soon as...
Please, Carrie.
Oh! Mikhail Baryshnikov in 2004 as the cold Russian boyfriend slapping Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City. And, of course, there's this guy.
Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, it can't be.
Say the name.
Boris and Natasha.
Ta-da!
Then we steal Matris, Boris.
Boris Badenov, who with his fellow spy, Natasha Fatal, took orders from fearless leader and Mr. Big and an arch enemy of Rocky and Bullwinkle. Do we process our feelings about Russia through our culture? It's serious business in the news, but let's have some fun with this with Harlow Robinson, history professor at Northeastern University, author of Russians in Hollywood, Hollywood's Russians. He joins us now. Professor Robinson, hello.
Hi there, Robin.
And we should say Boris and Natasha were actually spying for the fictional nation of Pottsylvania, but no one was fooled. So how did... Right. But how did this happen? You say the fear and fascination began with the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, the Tsar and his family murdered, the communist Bolsheviks' further goal was to overthrow capitalism. And this coincided with the birth of the American film industry, so there were movies made then. But move towards the 20s and 30s. What happened then?
Well, you know, the 1930s is interesting in that there was some positive feeling about the Soviet Union during the Depression, because that was the period when the American Communist Party was actually at its height. And there was a great deal of interest in Hollywood in trying to portray this a great new experiment in the Soviet Union. Ninotchka, late 1930s, is a satire. You know, it was made by Ernst Lubitsch, who had gone to the Soviet Union, and he was very disillusioned with what he saw. And he came back and made this satire about communism, and in the portrayal of Greta Garbo as this very uptight Soviet commissar who goes to Paris and is converted to capitalism.
Right, she's a great line. We have the high ideals, but they have the climate.
Right.
Let's listen to a scene from Ninotchka.
May I have your bags, madame?
Why?
He's a potter. He wants to carry them.
Why? Why should you carry other people's bags?
Well, that's my business, madame.
That's no business. That's social injustice.
That depends on the tip.
So then we continue through the World War II period, and you tell us that Roosevelt actually pushed studios to produce films that celebrated Russians because the Soviets were fighting the Nazis.
That's right. And the major studios all complied, and they produced some very bad films, actually, you'd have to say. North Star, which is actually written by Lillian Hellman and has a score by Aaron Copland, directed by Louis Milestone, who was a Russian-American. And it's set on the eve of the Nazi invasion in a Soviet village, and the people are wonderful. They're dancing and singing Broadway style, and then the Nazis arrive.
But then we go to the post-war films.
Very quickly, the atmosphere changed with the announcement of the Cold War, films vilifying Russians. In fact, communists were shown as basically being insane people.
Well, but where does Dr. Zhivago fit into this picture? 1965's Dr. Zhivago. Yeah. Let's just listen to a little of the theme. Now, we know you fell in love with the Russian culture, as many did, in 65, watching Dr. Zhivago. The book by Boris Pasternak, directed by David Lean, the music here by Maurice Jarret, starring Omar Sharif, Julie Christie, set in the First World War and the Russian Revolution. What spoke to you about this film, and what is it telling us at this point about how Americans feel about Russian culture?
Well, Dr. Zhivago was a very important film because it was the first big Hollywood film that really tried to present a balanced picture of what had happened in Russia during World War I and in the revolution. Dr. Zhivago did provide a good service in humanizing the Soviet Union for many people.
So Americans trying to work out their feelings about the Russians and maybe humanize them there in Dr. Zhivago, and maybe the next year even more humanize them, or maybe even cut them down to size. In The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, 1966, Alan Arkin, an officer on a Russian submarine that's purposely grounded off New England because the captain wants to see America. Here's Arkin coaching his crew on how to appear to be normal Americans trying to clear a route through the town.
Emergency, everybody to get from street. Хорошо, подберите все места. Emergency, everybody to get from street.
Nobody would think they were Russian. It's just so funny. They meet up with a vacationing Carl Reiner. Jonathan Winters is a bumbling police officer. Please download this movie. But what was this about? Not at all threatening.
Yes, well, after all, this is the late 60s. Make Love, Not War. So there were films that came out during this period that sort of were trying to puncture the Cold War hostility. And remember, the way that film ends is a boy is up on the top of a steeple and the Soviet sailors who are there and the Americans all join together to save him. You know, there were other satires as well. Think of Dr. Strangelove, which is very different, but also an attempt by Stanley Kubrick to puncture the Cold War hostility.
Go to the 80s. Ronald Reagan, president in 1984, building up the country's weapons stores to battle the frightening Soviets. At the same time, the 1984 film Red Dawn, you know, a football star is going out to beat the Russians who've invaded Midwestern America. Here's a clip.
It's World War III down there. People are being killed. Those could be Russians.
So it seems like the culture was sort of backing the policy. But then we come to the end of the Cold War, 1991. The wall has fallen. Russia is exposed as a bit of a paper giant. So did the Russian image get a makeover once the Soviet Union dissolved?
Well, there was a brief period in the 1990s. But what happened, though, is very quickly the Russians were transformed from bad communists into just gangsters.
I remember the Russians appeared in The Sopranos, Russian mobsters.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to fast forward to today. Take House of Cards first. The American president, spoiler alert if you haven't seen the whole thing, he becomes president, played by Kevin Spacey, is talking to the Russian president, Viktor Petrov, played by the Danish actor Lars Mikkelsen.
I'm jealous, Victor. You don't answer to anyone. You have no real opposition. You know exactly how every election is going to turn out. Well, it's not like that in the United States. I'm not running because I can do things a candidate can't do, like this proposal.
Please, Mr. President, we both know you'll run. Now, whether you win, who knows?
What? A Russian interfering with an American election? Okay, put that aside. Harlow Robinson, again, professor at Northeastern, helping us look at how Russians are portrayed in American culture. What is it about just using the Russian accent? I mean, this must be so insulting to Russians.
Well, I think it is somewhat insulting, although I think Russians kind of have, I've talked to my Russian friends about this, they kind of have a sense of humor about this. They have actually a word they use in Russian to describe this kind of kitsch, klyukva, which really means cranberry that's like on a vine. I don't know, they might take it personally, but I think they pretty much shrug it off as something rather funny. I mean, I think House of Cards, it's obviously modeled on the real personality of Putin.
Well, yes, but then there's The Americans, which is set in the 1980s and reflects true stories of Russian spy families. In the show, you've got the married Russian spies played by Matthew Rhys and Kerry Russell. Spoiler alert here, if like me, you're still on season two. They create a family in the U.S., but then really fall in love. And Philip, the dad, wants to come in from the cold. Elizabeth just can't. Let's listen.
I'm going to make a deal where you don't have to talk to the Americans if you don't want to, if you think that'll make you a traitor, but you will come with me and the kids. It won't be exactly what you want, but you'll adjust.
So you're just deciding for both of us?
Yeah, one of us has to.
Why you?
Because we're running out of time. Why can't we do this together?
Because I am a KGB officer. Don't you understand that? After all these years, I would go to jail. I would die. I would lose everything before I would betray my country.
Harlow, your thoughts? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's part of a long tradition. There was a film called Little Nikita, I think made in the 80s, 90s, about a sleeper family living in San Diego. So it's not entirely new. And after all, spy cases have been part of the texture of the Soviet-American relationship for a long time, going back to the 40s, the Rosenbergs, but certainly the realization that they really are out there.
So we have Boris Badenov, Moose and Squirrel, which
da,
all the way to the Americans. What else do your Russian friends tell you? Do they have the equivalent?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They really do not. There were certainly Soviet films during the Cold War period that portrayed Americans in a bad light. One of the classic Soviet films about America is something called The Russian Question, which portrays an American journalist who is sent to the Soviet Union by a Hearst-like editor in order to write a book that condemns communism and the Soviet Union. But instead, he goes and falls in love with the Soviet Union and the Soviet people. But that was in the late 40s. Really, today, they're really not as interested, I think, in portraying Americans. It's not a concern in the media.
Well, isn't that funny? Here we are, almost obsessed with
it.
Yeah, and they don't care.
Well, I think also you have to remember that American film and culture is so dominant. I was in Russia this last summer, and American films are shown everywhere, and American pop music. And so there's this just huge influence of American popular culture in Russia, despite the fact that the official rhetoric in Russia now is so anti-American.
That's Harlow Robinson, history professor at Northeastern University, author of Russians in Hollywood, Hollywood's Russians, Biography of an Image. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Спасибо.
What you said.
Thank you.
When someone tweeted the film Moscow on the Hudson, your nominee's welcome at hereandnow.org.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. So we know you like podcasts because you're listening to one, but all this month we want to ask you to go a step further and share the love. Find someone who has never downloaded a podcast, or maybe someone who doesn't even know they exist, and tell them about one that they'll enjoy. You'll be opening up an entirely new world to them. Whether it's this podcast or another, we'd love to know what you are recommending, so tell us with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
Hospital-acquired infections kill about 100,000 Americans every year, more than car wrecks, breast cancer, and AIDS combined. Across the country, dozens of companies are working to develop and produce no-touch disinfection devices that can be effective weapons in the fight against these microscopic threats. Wendy Rigby of Here and Now contributor, Texas Public Radio, looks at one such effort underway in San Antonio.
Methicillin-resistant staph, MRSA, C. diff, Clostridium difficile.
Viral, bacterial, and fungal infections can leave hospital patients sicker than when they came in.
All of them are really scary. They're all very deadly.
That's Morris Miller, CEO of Xenex, a company that manufactures germ-zapping robots. The robot looks a little like R2-D2 of Star Wars fame. It's a large metal cylinder about 4 feet tall with a domed top that lifts up to reveal the disinfecting light. Hospitals name their robots, calling them names like the Germinator, Hector the Disinfector, and Snap, Crackle, and Pop. The $100,000 machine packs a powerful punch. Using pulsed xenon light that's 1,400 times more intense than sunlight to kill pathogens on surfaces where they lurk. Miller says in a span of as little as 4 minutes, the robot can wipe out unseen threats 7 feet in every direction.
So you're talking about being able to do a huge amount of damage to pathogens in a very short period of time.
Xenex started 5 years ago with 5 employees. Now the company employs more than 100 people who make and sell robots to more than 400 hospitals around the country. San Antonio's University Hospital is one of them.
So we have 5 units in the hospital. We have another unit in the clinic, and they are used daily, constant use.
Infectious disease specialist Dr. Jason Bowling says no-touch disinfection, like the robot, is an extra layer of protection for patients, but only after humans have used chemicals and cloths to clean. His facility uses the robots to cut down on infections like drug-resistant staph, pneumonia, and a particularly horrible diarrhea-causing organism called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff.
But this bacteria forms spores, and these spores can sit in the environment, and they can sit on the surface for months to years. They also are not inactivated by standard hospital disinfectants.
Bowling says San Antonio's University Hospital has documented a 55% decrease in C. diff infections in 2016. He believes the robots are part of the reason why, along with hand washing and isolation precautions. At Morningside Ministries, a senior living community in San Antonio, three Xenex robots get a workout.
We let the robot do its thing and it destroys any germ.
Irene Salinas is vice president of clinical services. She says the nursing home and assisted living facilities are ripe for infection spread since the living setting is communal.
We use them every single day.
Morningside Ministries zaps 23 rooms a day with robots.
And these robots just add an extra layer of protection.
Dr. Bowling says he likes the idea that the robot standardizes cleaning, since crews aren't always complete.
When you put in this machine that bathes the room in light, you're standardizing that disinfection.
Hospital-acquired infections are the number one complication of being in the hospital. That's why new technologies using powerful UV light to kill the germs are catching on quickly. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
The Congressional Budget Office will be releasing its score of the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. The CBO's report will estimate the plan's cost and consequences, such as how many people might lose their current insurance. So this week, we're going to take a deeper look at several aspects of the health insurance marketplace. And today, we'll begin with health savings accounts. President Donald Trump mentioned them when talking about health coverage in his address to Congress last month.
We should help Americans purchase their own coverage through the use of tax credits and expanded health savings accounts. But it must be the plan they want, not the plan forced on them by our government.
But what exactly are health savings accounts and how do they work? Well, joining us now to talk about it is Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, it's great to talk with you.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so we're going to be adding to the alphabet soup of accounts here with HSAs. So, you know, in a nutshell, what are they?
Well, HSAs are health savings accounts. Previously, they were called medical savings accounts. This is something that Republicans have been saying for years, that the problem with health insurance, the problem with health care cost, is that there is an insurer and a provider, and the individual never knows how much anything costs because the insurer pays for it, and you get this sort of incomprehensible document from your insurer. So the idea with a health savings account is that people would be more responsible for their own bill. So they would find out how much things cost. If consumers had a better idea of how much medical care costs, they would spend less. That would get providers to compete. It would drive down healthcare spending overall. That's the theory.
Okay. And so let's get into some of the specifics then. One of the advantages that people point to with health savings account is as they're currently written, you get there's a sort of triple effect, triple tax break effect here. If you're able to find enough money to put in a health savings account.
That's right. It's one of the most tax-advantaged accounts you can find. The money is tax-free going in. It is tax-free as it grows over the years if you don't use it. And it is tax-free coming back out as long as you use it for qualified medical expenses. In fact, if you don't use it for qualified medical expenses, it's still only a 20% penalty, which, depending on what your tax bracket is, might be still more favorable than other forms of saving and spending.
Mm. And so currently, what are the caps in terms of how much you can put into a health savings account every year?
Well, right now, and this is one of the things that Republicans complain about, individuals can put in $3,400 a year, and they can put in $6,700 a year if they're a family. Individuals can put the money in, employers can put the money in, and then the money would not be counted towards that person's, towards the worker's taxable income. Generally, individuals put in more money than employers do, and you can then spend out as much money a year as your deductible or your maximum out-of-pocket costs. And we should point out that health savings accounts are intended, in fact, can only be used in conjunction with a high deductible health insurance plan. So there is a catastrophic plan underneath of this. The question is whether you can afford to put as much into this health savings account as you would need to reach that deductible.
Right. Okay. So we're going to get into that in just a minute because that's kind of one of the cruxes of the matter when it comes to the debate over these health savings accounts. But I just wanted to play a little bit of tape here from House Speaker Paul Ryan, because he has said that in Republican plan, the new health care plan put forward by Republicans, that they would double the amount of money that you can contribute to one of these HSAs from the caps that you mentioned to us earlier, Julie. So here's Paul Ryan.
And so what health savings accounts achieves, this is the law that I helped write in 2003, something that we as conservatives have been fighting for the whole time, is we want to increase health savings accounts, which is what we do in this bill, so we have more competition and lower costs.
So that was Paul Ryan there. But if just say that we did get the amount, the caps doubled here on these HSAs, Julie, that means for a family could ostensibly put away some $13,000 a year in one of these HSAs. But that's presuming you have it, right? That's
exactly.
So who's most advantaged when it comes to these HSAs?
Well, and this has been the case from the very beginning when these first started as a little pilot program in 1996, that they benefit most people who are healthy, so they don't use a lot of money for healthcare, and people who are wealthy, so they have enough money sitting around that they can put into these accounts. As I mentioned, employers can put money in, but the average employer contribution is under $1,000. So if you really want to get it, funded all the way up to where you would be protected in case of a serious health problem, you would have to have, if you're a family, $13,000 to put away.
Right. I mean, looking at a 2015 Health Affairs Journal article, it was a study from a couple of folks out of George Washington University. They found that across all age groups, people with the highest incomes, over $100,000 or so, were the most likely to have these health savings accounts and to max out the amount that they could put in it, thereby achieving the greatest tax benefit from it. So it makes you wonder, for low-income folks, is there any advantage at all to even putting in, I don't know, $5, $10, however much they could put aside?
Well, there is some advantage if you owe anything in taxes. Remember, there are a lot of people who don't earn enough to owe anything in taxes. Then there's obviously no tax advantage to this. For them to have, you know, there's some talk about health savings accounts even in Medicaid for very low-income people. If there is an account that can help you pay your out-of-pocket costs, that is always going to be a good thing. But the tax advantages of this obviously accrue to people in higher tax brackets. People who have a larger tax bill will then save more by being able to put money away tax-free.
Yeah. And now, how is this money in the health savings account managed? Is it like an actual like bank savings account, or is it managed by professional management groups? Do we know?
It's generally managed by professional management groups. It's a lot like your 401k. It's, you know, think of it as a personal retirement account, but for healthcare. So it can be just cash, or it can be other kinds of investments. But yes, generally the banking industry has a big interest in this because they, you know, make some of the money off of the management fees.
Yeah, I'm seeing that one of the major management groups here, Health Equity, this is in an article from CNN, saying that they're seeing profit margins of 57% on their 2.7 million health savings accounts. So lots of money to be made there in the management of it. But Julie, you mentioned 401ks here. So is this sort of the healthcare analogy to a 401k, that you're putting your own money in and it's being managed for you, but then you can take it out and use it as you want?
Exactly. It really is the healthcare, corollary to the 401k. Although the idea is that people will use this money, you know, where your 401k goes until you retire. The idea is your health savings account would come out as you needed it for healthcare expenses. I should point out that the high deductible health plans that have to go along with this are required to cover certain preventive care before you reach your deductible. So that would be covered by the insurance plan. The other advantage to having an insurance plan and not just a savings account is that you generally, if you stay within your plan's network, you will get the negotiated rate, which is good for you, but it kind of defeats the purpose of people then finding out really how much healthcare costs, because now you're getting a rate that was negotiated by your insurance company.
Right. And so just sticking with this 401k analogy here for a second, I mean, I imagine that folks hearing that might think, wait a minute, but like managing my 401k is really complicated. I'm not exactly sure what the best thing to do with the money is. And also, it's not enough for my retirement anyway, because I can't save enough. I mean, you were sort of touching on that just now. But I mean, are those some of the potential same drawbacks if health savings accounts do get expanded?
Well, this is a little bit different because, again, you do have insurance underneath of this, so that once you hit your out-of-pocket maximum, then almost everything will be covered.
Right.
And it varies, but so the and which you don't have with your 401k. Your 401k, your you know, goal is to just grow it and grow it and grow it until you have enough money to live on in retirement. This is exclusively for supposedly exclusively for medical conditions, and there would be much more activity or in theory, there would be more activity in and out of the HSA, you know, during the course of your working life.
Yeah. And finally, Julie, is there it seems like there's quite a bit of momentum with health savings accounts. You just mentioned briefly a bit earlier programs that are considering expanding it into Medicaid and possibly even Medicare recipients.
Yes, well, this was debated very hotly about Medicare and HSAs already. They're not there yet, but there is a lot of talk. You know, again, at what I talked about at the beginning, this is the Republican concept here is that one of the ways to bring healthcare costs down is to get consumers more involved in understanding how much healthcare costs and do some comparison shopping. The bad news is that is still really hard to do. We've now had some form of HSAs for more than 20 years, and it is still really hard to find out how much an MRI costs or how much a CAT scan costs. And that's for, you know, that's assuming you have time to go shopping for an elective service. If you're in an emergency,
right.
You know, you take what you have.
And again, assuming you've got the money to put away. Julie Rovner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
There is a super bloom blanketing the deserts of the Southwest. It's just what it sounds like, dazzling desert flowers brought on by California's heavy rains. And people are lining up at the Anza Borrego Desert State Park in San Diego County to see the evening primrose, desert lily, sand verbena. Larry Hendrickson is a botanist at the state parks, including Anza Borrego. He's here on Skype. And Larry, we're hearing it's the most lush the desert has been in a decade. What are you seeing?
Well, it is a very good year for the bloom. We had substantial rain this winter, and most people think of it as spring wallflowers. They're actually winter annual flowers. The main one that we're seeing out in the north part of the park is the desert sunflower, beautiful golden daisy, just a field of it. The dune evening primrose, the beautiful white primrose, popcorn flowers, a little tiny white flowered annual. You just have to explore the area.
And by the way, talk about these are annuals. They're also called ephemerals, ephemeral because mm-hmm. they're fleeting. And what happens? Like they're there in the ground, but the seeds don't sprout until there's rain?
That's correct. Ideally, a little bit of fall rain to break the dormancy of the seeds. Of course, because of the harsh conditions in the desert, many of these plants are adapted to these conditions. And so they wait until conditions are just right for them to germinate and flower. A lot of folks come to the, to Borrego Valley, which is a great place to visit. But the park is huge. It's over 940,000 acres, extending all the way from about a mile north of the international border up to Riverside County. It's a really large park.
Well, we're reading reports of the first sighting ever of Bigelow's monkey flower, sand blazing star, purple mat. They all sound gorgeous. And are people surprised? Because as you've explained, these seeds are there. They're just waiting, sometimes years, for the right rain. But it's the desert. And we normally think that it only gets about 5 inches of rain a year.
We had substantial. I don't know the exact numbers, but we had substantial rain this December and in January, and it triggered a really beautiful bloom. I think everyone is excited. We've had several dry years.
What does this mean for the ecosystem? Caterpillars, beetles, everything else in the ecosystem?
Well, it is. It's an amazing combination of plants, insects, animals. We have also a hawk watch. The Swainson's hawks migrate through here. They consume the caterpillars that also are consuming the plants. So it's an interesting and really unique ecosystem here.
Well, and these flowers will benefit these the caterpillars, the beetles. However, the caterpillars and the beetles will be part of why they're going to disappear. Now, we said that they were ephemerals. They are fleeting. They're also going to get eaten. So how long will this last?
It depends. We've been having some rather warm weather recently, and that is going to trigger the plants to bolt and to produce seed and then go dormant again. people come down here, and it's just spectacular right now along Henderson Canyon Road, north of Borrego Springs. The desert sunflower is just fields of desert sunflower and the dune evening primrose. It's just spectacular right now.
Wish we could be there. Well, the closest thing, there are websites we'll link you to, and also there's a wildflower hotline. But I understand people are coming from, you know, several states away, so I hope you all continue to enjoy it. That's Larry Hendrickson, botanist at the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, where there is a super bloom. It's a colloquial term, but we love it. Larry, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
So we have blooms out west. Here on the East Coast, we are bracing for a major blizzard, which we are not calling
Nada!
Because our fearless NPR wordsmith, Mark Memmott, asked us not to. Let's check in with Mark real quick. Mark, in your Memmott memo today, you said we cannot say
Nada!
Because why?
Well, the Weather Channel has named winter storms, but no government authority has, no agency has. And so why help the Weather Channel market, basically, itself?
Yeah, it's not real. And we're also not going to say big chill, hunker down, deep freeze, old or old man winter. No cliches.
Well, we're going to try. I can't guarantee that you and some of your compatriots might not try to sneak a few on there.
Yeah, but can we say weather bomb or snow bomb? This has to do with bombogenesis when the central pressure of a low pressure system drops, you know, 24 millibars in 24 hours. I think it's a real weather thing.
Yes, it is. And you've just gone on and explained why you would use weather bomb or snow bomb and given people some information.
Okay, so we may say that. Mark, we thank you as always.
Thank you. Good luck up there.
Thank you. And you too. And no. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome.
I have to give credit to you, Meghna. That was your idea.
Oh, dear.
For the name that. But what are some of the other things?
I'll never get a job again.
What else can't we say?
We are not allowed to say enough is enough, although maybe it already is enough. Snowpocalypse, Snowmageddon, Winter Wonderland, nipping at our noses, or nipping at anything else.
Wait, no nipping. No nipping.
White out on all of those.
Well, Meghna, I really hope you can brave the elements. Oops. Banned.
Banned. Yeah, I'm boot deep in it already.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.